good evening, and welcome to Bird Calls, made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and by the 5th Annual Lost Pines Christmas Bird Count Weekend, hosting workshops for birding enthusiasts on Saturday, December 19th at the Hyatt Regency Lost Pines Resort and Spa near Bastrop. Workshops will be taught by experts from the University of Texas at Austin, Texas A&M University, the University of Southern California, and more. The official bird count takes place on December 20th. More information is at www.visitlostpines.com. We invite you to tune in and call in tonight with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world during the show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks for joining us tonight.
And speaking of East Texas, it's very much underwater today.
Yeah, well, so is Shreveport. I thought I was going to have to get a rowboat out earlier. Yes. just to get through my own parking lot where I live. So, well, folks, if you can give us a call tonight, maybe your birds are all wet and you need to know what to do, give us a call at 800-552-8502. No need to fill your bird bath right now. I think it's probably full of fresh water.
Yeah, the birds probably want to get a little dry.
So, yeah, no, you need a blow dryer out there. We'll get one of those things you find in the restroom. So, well, give us a call, folks, 800-552-8502 with your questions about birds. And we're going to go to a refresher tonight on last month's conservation tip.
Yeah, last month we talked about the federal duck stamp. It's not intended for postal use. It's instead, it's intended to protect wetland habitat that ducks use, and all sorts of other water birds, herons and egrets and rails and gallinules and shorebirds and on any bird that occurs near the water really benefits from the federal duck stamp. So what we recommended is, and you need to do so annually, is purchase the duck stamp, because those monies are used to buy and protect wetland habitat for all these birds.
And is this something when you go to the post office, you specifically say, I would like the duck stamp?
Yeah, most, not all, but most post offices carry it, and also places that that sell hunting and fishing licenses sell it. And then at least in Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and the listening area, those states have it set up where you can buy it online. And they make great gifts. So if you've got a nature lover, a bird watcher, a wildlife photographer in your family, they make great gifts to buy a duck stamp. They cost $25. You need to buy it every year. Just think of it as a membership to Red River Radio or to your conservation group or whatever it is that you donate to every year.
It reminds me of the movie Fargo, where the husband of the sheriff in the movie was an artist, and he was trying to get his duck on a stamp.
That's right. Yeah. And that's very competitive, and tell you that it's just astounding at the artists that do that. There are some brothers that the Houtmans, they have won it. I think there's three brothers now, but when I used to pay attention, there were two brothers, but I think there's a third. And among those brothers, they often win every year. And it's pretty impressive, and those stamps are beautiful. And then you can buy prints that go on the wall, too, because as a stamp, it's kind of little, hard to see the detail, but the prints are just amazing. But that's a big deal among wildlife artists to get your print on the stamp.
Well, give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with your questions about anything dealing with birds. And we're going to go to this month's bird spotlight, and then we have Dale online. We'll get to you in just a moment, Dale. But what's this month's bird spotlight?
We profile a different species every month, or every episode, rather. In this episode, we're doing the brown thrasher. And here, let's listen. That smacking. Keep listening. there, that whistle. So the smack and the whistle are both a brown thrasher. You can also hear another bird, the goldfinch, in there.
We'll go to a clip with that.
Let's listen.
Real different.
Right. The first part, so it was two species calling on top of each other.
Right.
The first one is the brown thrasher. Listen again. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the chirp is the brown thrasher, and the chee was the goldfinch. So the thrasher is it's a bird that I think a lot of hunters, especially duck and deer hunters, because those are winter activities, when they go out before sunrise, they often hear the brown thrasher because these are often the first songbirds that vocalize before sunrise. It's usually not the sound we just heard, but often you'll hear a loud sound that resembles air being let out of a tire tube, kind of a, and you'll hear that coming from the bushes or the shrubs or the thickets, and you'll think, what is that? Well, it's probably the brown thrasher. There are 8 species of thrashers in the U.S., but the brown thrasher is the only one expected and found reliably in the Red River Radio listening area. They're named for their ability to thrash around in the leaf litter with their bill as they search for food, things like insects, seeds, fruits, and other food items. Thrashers are in the same family as the mockingbird, and so both are mimics, which means that they both imitate the sounds made by other species of birds around them. But the difference is this thrasher imitates sounds in duplicate, whereas the mockingbird in triplicate. So let's say a bird it's hearing is doing chirps and tweets. So a brown thrasher would say it twice, chirp, chirp, and then move to something else, tweet, tweet, in duplicate. But the mockingbird is going to be chirp, 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 tweet, tweet, tweet. So you can often tell who it is just by counting what you hear. So the brown thrasher is related to the mockingbird. It's larger than the mockingbird. It's heavily streaked underneath with a smooth, rusty brown color above and a long tail. They really like thickets and brush piles, woody fence rows, dense shrubs, and the like. In urban areas, I see them in my yard. They often tiptoe out into the edges of the mowed lawn, but they quickly retreat back to the dense thickets when they're spooked or startled. So to me, they have severe stage fright. They'd rather skulk in the dark shadows under the bushes. It's one of my favorite backyard birds, especially when they sing, but the whole family likes it when they hit the bird bath because they get in there and just splash that water everywhere and make a mess, and really fun to watch. So watch for the brown thrasher on in your property.
You can give us a call right now to get your questions into Cliff at 800-552-8502. This is Bird Calls from Red River Radio. And we actually have an image of a brown thrasher as well as the American goldfinch up on our website now. The American goldfinch contributed by Friends of Red River Radio up at Caddo Lake, Michaela Lynn Strong. And we have another bird by her that she submitted on there as well. She's up there shooting some photographs, and she got a couple of nice pictures. And tell us what the other ones are.
Yeah. If listeners want to go to the web and look at these later, they can. The bird on the seed feeder is a goldfinch.
Right.
And we don't get them in the summertime in that very yellow canary color. What we do is we get them in their drab winter plumage during the colder months. So that's what you see on this feeder. It's got very striking black and white wings, but a very dull, dingy bird with some hints of yellowy in the face. And that's the American goldfinch. They're usually in groups. They're very tiny birds, and they really like thistle and black oil sunflower seeds. The other picture that's up with it, done by the same photographer, is of another American. So that's the American goldfinch. And mm-hmm. This one, coincidentally, is the American robin. What some people call a robin redbreast. It's the
right.
one sitting on a chain link fence in the photograph.
Right.
And that's a bird that we have year round, but we get a huge influx in the winter. So coming down after the cold snaps, we mm-hmm. get big influxes of robins. They're coming down here to eat our mistletoe and our juniper berries and our hackberries and so forth. And they wander around. So a lot of people are wondering sometimes where the robins are, but the big flocks move around. If you see them in your yard, you better pay attention because they're stripping the berries off the trees and the bushes. And guess what? When the refrigerator's empty, they got to go.
Yeah.
So don't expect the big flocks of 200 robins to stick around for more than a day or two because, for example, in my yard, they hit the black cherry. They'll hit the neighbor's shrubs, the holly. And once that food is gone, the birds are gone. And they're wandering somewhat nomadically because of food. Food drives everything.
Right.
It drives migration. It drives the birds' movement around through the day. They're not going to just sit there and starve to death, right? So they're going to find fresh food that's available.
You are listening to Bird Calls, and we have our first caller online. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. Dale is up next. Kyle, you're online. Please hold on. Dale from Mooringsport, what's your call tonight? What's your question for Cliff?
Yes, what time of year should I clean out my birdhouses?
Well, right now would be a good time because the bird boxes, if you're talking about bluebird, wood duck, those are probably two of the most popular ones. This is a good time to do that. When the pair bonding is part of that pair bonding is building the nest inside that bird box. So a lot of people need to get the old nest material out. Plus it gets mushy. It can get, you know, covered in parasites and other insects. So I would do it now. And don't wait because bluebirds and wood ducks, they will nest pretty early in our listening area. They'll be certainly looking for cavities in January, February, and they might start laying in late February through mid-March. So you don't want to wait too long on that. But now's a great time because none of those birds are going to be nesting. Now, some of those boxes could be used for roosting. And that means sleeping in birds. So I know a lot of people that have opened up their wood duck box in the winter to find an eastern screech owl sleeping in there.
Yeah.
How cool would that be? And then brown-headed nuthatches, they will get in family groups inside nest boxes in the winter when it's cold to kind of save heat. And eastern bluebirds do that as well. So you want to make sure you do it in the middle of the day. Don't do it at dusk when birds could be in there to roost. And it's not very likely that they are, but it does happen.
Well, thank you very much. Yep. I was wondering. I couldn't find it in a magazine or anything, but I'm glad you told me.
Yeah. So, yeah, get on it now. It's a good November project for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dale.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight with any questions you have about our avian world at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Kyle, you left us. If you'd like to call back now, we have lines open and we're ready to take your calls. And I'm going to go to our next question. Our underwriter for this is the bird count going on over at Bastrop, but you're coming up with your own 116th annual Christmas bird count. Can you tell us where things are for that?
Yeah, there are dozens and dozens of Christmas bird counts within a short drive of most of us. And they happen during a three-week window of time. They're set to a specific date. The idea is to do this count every year at the same time, and kind of like with your kid that at their birthday you put them up against the kitchen door and measured their height, and then after a while you saw how Joey grew or Betty got taller. Well, same thing with these bird counts. You try to do them every year, and after 30 or 40 years of data, you can start seeing changes, and we've definitely seen changes. We've seen things like rusty blackbirds almost disappear, purple finches getting to be very difficult to find, but then we'll see things that are increasing. Ring-billed gulls, for example, in the South just seem to be skyrocketing on counts. So I would suggest if people are interested to look for a Christmas bird count in your area. There are two or three in the greater Shreveport area, and find that count compiler. That person is critical because he or she will help stick you in an area. If you're new, they'll put you with seasoned bird watchers, which is really a good way to learn birds, is to get stuck in a group with somebody that knows what they're doing, and you can really learn a lot. It's a 15-mile diameter circle. These count circles, and yeah, I think that there's about 70,000 people that do this at about 2,300 locations in the Western Hemisphere. And as you said, Bill, this is our 116th year to do it. Unfortunately, I didn't do all of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd be 116
yeah,
at least. So
I'd be in good shape, though, because those birds make you young, don't they?
Well, from going back through the data, have you seen, I know, you know, as we progressed into the last century, you get into the 50s, you probably see things really dipping off as industrial pollution kind of spiked in the 50s and 60s. Have you seen a resurgence of a lot of these species over the past, like, say, three, four decades from the data?
Right. Well, I think that's a good point with DDT. I think that a lot of these birds that relied on wetlands and eating fish and things like, we're talking about brown pelicans on the coast, bald eagles inland or on the coast, peregrines, ospreys, white-faced ibis, et cetera. These birds showed really steep declines, but I think, you know, it's pretty clear that the common thread for these birds and their rebounding is we've taken DDT off the market.
And that seemed to be a major killer.
And you can look at that with Christmas bird count data because, I mean, these birds were just down in lowest numbers. But the interesting thing, Frank Chapman was an ornithologist who started the Christmas bird counts, and he did it kind of to counter what was the typical Christmas tradition, was to go out and shoot as many birds as you could, didn't matter what they were, and you piled them up. You didn't mean that you were going to eat them either, but typically it was a family event. You would try to compete with your family's next door or down the street or at the next farm and see how many birds you could kill. So this was a way to counter that, because Frank Chapman was probably a visionary, because he could say, hey, right, this is not going to last forever. And so he said, why don't we just count birds instead of shooting them and counting the pile of dead birds? So that's where it started in 1900, and now 116 years later, it's still going strong and growing. There are now counts in Latin America. You can do counts in the tropics in countries like Ecuador and see hundreds of species in a day. It's pretty impressive.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have Sam, you're online. You're on hold right now. Please stay with us. But Laura from South Arkansas, we're coming to you next. What's your question for Cliff?
Hey, Cliff. This year I had my first experience with a catbird.
Okay.
And I'm curious, one, why they sound like a cat, because they can fake you out really well.
Yep.
And two, what species or what other birds are they the family of?
The catbird, I'm glad you brought the catbird up, because the bird we profiled a minute ago was the brown thrasher, and he's related to the mockingbird. He's a mimic in the family Mimidae, and the catbird is also in that family. So the catbird, to answer your second question, is related to mockingbirds, thrashers, and allies. And its full name is gray catbird. And what time of the year did you have your catbird?
Oh, I don't know. It was nesting out.
Uh-huh. Summer, hot summer months.
Summertime.
Yeah.
And I kept looking for the cat that was stuck under the floorboard.
Yeah, I think it's just coincidence. They're not imitating a cat. It's just coincidence that their call note sounds like a meow. And
yes,
it is impressive. But once they start singing, they have a very dim, not very loud song. It's I mentioned how the brown thrasher does duplicate and the mockingbird and triplicate. Well, the catbird does everything in singles, so it really changes tunes. What these birds do is they hear other species in their territory and they'll imitate them. So one second you'll hear the mockingbird do a red-bellied woodpecker, and he quickly goes to tufted titmouse, and he quickly goes to blue jay, etc. So the catbird, he's more of a mumbler, I'd say, and I like that, because to me the mockingbird's a little too loud. I like it a little softer. And the catbird, we had that bird breed in our backyard 1 year of the 8 years we've been in our current residence, and I love that bird, and I'm so disappointed that it didn't come back. So hopefully yours will come back, because they are cool. And we saw the fledglings. I took pictures of the babies. There's nothing very exciting about them. It wasn't until the parent came to feed that I even knew what it was, because it was this gray fuzzball.
Yeah.
But what a great bird. And the neat thing is, we get a few catbirds that are fairly tolerant of the weather and can overwinter with us. But majority, I'd say 99.5% of our gray catbirds leave and head to the tropics for the winter months. But if you look at the Christmas bird count data, that's one that in mild years especially can linger. I had one on Saturday. What was that date? Probably November 7th. Is that right? Oh. And I had one in Nacogdoches on the Bonita Creek Trail, and so I'm hoping it sticks around for the count. They're quiet in the winter months. They're skulking in the brush. They don't like to sit up and sing like they did back in the summer months, so they're kind of hard to find in the winter, but they sure like the thickets, and they love berries.
An interesting beak,
and you know, they're very one color gray, but the cap on the top of the head is dark. It's almost a black, and then under the tail in the area we call the chrism is kind of a maroon color. So they're really cool birds. I really love the catbird. They're pretty approachable. They're not real skittish like the brown thrasher. So yeah, I hope your catbird comes back next spring and summer.
Well, we'll look for it. Thank you for all the info, Mama.
Okay, Laura. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He's here tonight with us to answer your questions about our avian world, anything to have to do with birds. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Sam, you're online next. Tell us where you're from, Sam, and go ahead and ask your question.
I'm calling from down in Natchitoches Parish in Campy.
All right. And what's your question?
Why are ospreys so rare here?
I won't be able to answer why at a local level they're rare. I mean, if you've got open water, I don't see why you wouldn't have them. The neat thing about ospreys, most of them are on the go. Most months of the year, there's not a month really that goes by that we can't see an osprey.
I've been in the last 10 years, I've seen one. I just saw one at Toledo Bend.
Uh-huh.
If you go like in Florida, they seem to be as common as crows. They're just everywhere.
Yeah, and especially in the breeding season, they nest very commonly as you get into Florida. But over here, we have very few nest records, but we make up for it in the winter months. Are you also thinking in the winter you don't see them very much?
I've seen one osprey in 10 years.
Okay. Are you an angler by chance? Because I think our anglers probably see a lot more of them.
Yeah, I live on Black Lake, and I've never seen one there. I've seen bald eagles. I've seen a peregrine. I've never seen an osprey.
Yeah, I don't know the answer.
I'm just sort of like, there's all this water here. I'm always sort of surprised.
Yeah, I don't know. Is that a big body of water? I don't know that.
Yeah, it's
okay.
Very large. Black Lake, yeah.
Yeah, I can't answer that because I would have suspected you'd have osprey there at least 10 months of the year. And they should be there at least 9 or 10 months of the year. I don't know.
They tend to like to nest up real high, don't they?
You know any nesting populations over there in Texas?
Yeah, we don't have a whole lot. I'd say that we have less than 10 pairs in the East Texas area that we know about.
Huh.
And so not very common. I mean, there were, when I started looking, paying attention to all this in the area 25, 30 years ago, there was only maybe one or two that we knew about. So they're just not very common. They're not expected. There's a new reservoir, fairly new reservoir north of me called Natchitoches Creek, Lake Natchitoches. It dammed up Lake Natchitoches Creek, and there was an osprey nest on there for a couple years. And their nest placement's very different than bald eagles. The osprey like the snags that are out in the water that are topped, meaning that it's not branchy, it's just a flat, it's a big diameter tree that's just shaved at the top, where they can put the nest on it, versus a bald eagle will be typically in a branchy tree, typically a live tree, and typically over land. So they really like pines, loblolly especially, where you have a whorl WHORL. Wow. And you have several branches coming out, and that's where bald eagles like to put their nests. So I think that bald eagles probably find nest substrate a lot easier than osprey do, because if you want, like the osprey, if you want the tree that's out in the water and the big tree, there's a short lifespan, because guess what happens? Those trees that are in the water for years and decades, they eventually fall over. So they don't have as long of a lifespan. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why you've got a local issue there with osprey. Mm-hmm. I just don't know the answer. I mean, if you've got fish and you say you have bald eagles and anglers, you should have osprey.
Huh, okay.
Yep.
I've yet to see them, but I'll keep an eye out.
Okay, all right.
Let us know. Call us back if you find some.
Yep, thank you, Sam.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We're going to go next to Clyde from Nacogdoches, that is. Clyde, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I'm wondering about scarlet tanagers.
Okay.
We have... seen one not recently. It just, in fact, we saw it at church. We were getting out of the car heading for church, and it came diving across the parking lot, just flying, you know, like it was going somewhere.
Yeah.
But I obviously there's at least some here, but I don't recall having seen any others at all since that one. And I'm just wondering what you can tell me about them as residents.
As residents, so...
Or visitors.
Yeah. Scarlet tanager, that's the all-red one with the black, jet black wings and tail. They're only a migrant.
That was it.
Yeah. And they're only a migrant in Nacogdoches, where you and I live. You have to get up to the Ouachita Mountains. It's about as close as we can get to breeding. So maybe Waldron, Arkansas, that far north is where you start picking up breeding. So we're only in the migration route. So, and I only see them in the spring migration. They're
This one was in springtime.
Okay, good. Because they're pretty darn hard to find in the fall. And so I don't know if you had, maybe church just coincided with migration. Their peak is going to be late April into early May. So I'm guessing your date was, you know, April 15 to May 10, somewhere in there.
I don't recall.
Yeah.
Well, spring is about all I can.
Right, think. But that's really the window where they really pour through. The females are kind of a French mustard yellow color to them, because we have another tanager that's here in the breeding season. It stays with us for 6 months or more, and that's the summer tanager, but it's just all red with no black wings and no black tail. But they stay and breed here in the listening area, and they're very common. And the females of those are more of a spicy mustard yellow, spicy yellow mustard color versus the French yellow mustard. It's real subtle, but you can really see that. The bill is a little different too. And then it's best, if you have trouble with the female tanagers, just wait to see if it's breeding season who the boyfriend is she hooks up with, and because the males are very different. But both species of tanagers leave the U.S. and head to the tropics in Latin America to overwinter. So we have very few records of either of those tanagers. There are some lingering individuals, some that'll overwinter. We don't know if they just couldn't make the migration, but they're still healthy enough to survive on the coast in a woodlot on the coast of Texas or Louisiana. But for the most part, tanagers get the heck out of here and go to the tropics in Latin America, so Mexico and points farther south. So that's cool that you saw one at church. How about that?
Oh, yeah. Just, we were, you know, he came, and it was definitely he. I mean, you talk about that just red, a red bird as I've ever
that's
seen
right.
in my life.
Yep.
And
it really really contrasts against those black wings and tail.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
Saw it, and you know, I said to my wife, "That was a scarlet tanager."
Well, that's pretty neat. Yep, you're gonna have to start taking your binoculars to church, aren't you?
Take your camera.
Maybe. well, at least I wasn't just thinking I saw it.
No, and you know, if there's inclement weather, that's really the time, that window I mentioned, that latter half of April first 10 days or so of May in this area. If we get any bad weather at night, that next morning can be very productive, because most of these birds, like these tanagers and other migrants like vireos and warblers, are flying at night. And so it's when they're flying at night and there's a downpour and it grounds them. And they don't take flight in the morning, so they're usually making the most of it and refueling. And that's when the bird watchers go bonkers, because we call that a fallout. So you can see a lot of scarlet tanagers after a fallout. And I've seen some at one of our migrant, what we call a migrant trap. It's basically a woodlot with really good trees that's attractive to these migrants. And in Nacogdoches, where you live, Clyde, Pecan Park is one of our Birded Watchers' favorite migrant traps. And I've been there after a fallout and seen 8 to 10 male summer tanagers in one view. No telling how many were in the grove there. I think that grove is, 18 acres or something. It's small. But there could have been dozens. Let me tell you, if you see scarlet tanagers, and they'll be also with male Baltimore orioles and several warblers, it looks like Christmas ornaments on the trees. And the tough part is they're usually pretty darn high up, so you're going to need binoculars and you're going to have some patience. But it sounds like you just need to find your church and go at the right time and see the scarlet tanager on your way into church.
Let's see. I'm sure that I've seen it, looked it up, but what do scarlet tanagers like to feed on?
The tanagers both really eat a lot of insects, and they're up in the canopy. They're eating bugs. They're eating some fruit and some seeds, but for the most part, it's insects. And the lack of insects are the big reason why a lot of these birds leave us. When the insects shut down, then it's time to get out of here.
Yep. Makes sense.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Clyde.
I really enjoy your show.
Oh, great. Thanks, Clyde.
Clyde, we appreciate it. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. All lines are open. That's 800-552-8502. As we continue here with our show, Cliff is our resident ornithologist, as I said, and he's also the non-game ornithologist, the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we're going to go next to a question that I have, and that is, as we get into the, we're already in the migration season, what can folks do to help those species that are passing through our area but aren't going to necessarily winter here, but if they want to be, bird friendly, what can they do?
Yeah, fall migration for the most part is done for most species. There's still a trickle of things that you shouldn't expect seeing this late, but there's still going to be a trickle of things like broadwing hawks that could be a late migrant. But for the most part, fall migration's done. I think what we have now are birds settling in for winter. But to answer your question, back for fall migration, I would say having in your yard, just having shrubs and trees that that put out fruits and seeds that birds want. So and go native. So we really, really push native species of berry-giving shrubs and trees. So in my backyard right now and in fall migration, the beauty berries were really hopping and a lot of things were eating those. We had several days where the Baltimore Orioles were coming in and eating on the beauty berries, but they had to watch out because the resident mockingbird was really guarding his beauty berries. But there were so many, there were thousands of them. He could have shared them, and he did. So we did see the Orioles sneak in for a bite, but that's what I'd recommend for fall. And also with these shrubs, these native plants, you would be attracting insects. And I'm not talking about mosquitoes and flies that bother us, but other kinds of insects that are attracted to the plants that the birds glean off of the trees and shrubs, off of the leaves. So this is better than just having a mowed lawn of San Augustine from fence to fence. You're going to limit yourself in how many birds you have in your property if you're going to just have a golf course from edge to edge and nothing else. So to answer your question again, I'd say go for wildscapes, go for species that gives berries in the fall, and seeds in the fall, and insects too.
And natural plants to the environment, yeah. You know, natural, yes. Native plants.
Native, so. That can handle this weird weather, like the 5 inches of rain we got today. and then we might not get rain for a while, though they're talking about this being an El Nino yeah. winter, so we'll get a lot of rain. But also that wildscape we're talking about for the fall, guess what? Those are all perennials that we're talking about. So they're going to come back in the spring, and guess what? They're the spring migrants coming that are going to want food, and you've got the cover for them to use your yard and show themselves, so you can see them out your window, and it makes it really easy.
So if you're a bird lover, go wild, go natural.
That's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open. We're going to go next to Otis from Anacoka, Louisiana. Otis, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi. I live here in the Piney Woods. And in fact, the property directly behind me was bought by the Army, and they've turned it into a wildlife management area as well. But I guess it's been about a month ago is the last time I heard it. There's something off in the woods there that sounds kind of like a cat meowing, kind of soft, but it ends up with another sound. And I'm assuming it's a bird. I don't know what it is.
Well, one of the earlier callers talked about the catbird, and I mentioned how some of them do stick around in the colder months. Did you hear that cat meow recently?
It's been about a month ago, okay. And it's always in the evening after dark.
Well, it could have been a catbird. My guess is it's gone. Also, I find that a woodpecker called the yellow-bellied sapsucker makes kind of a cat-like call. I'm going to imitate it here. It makes a and to me, it sounds like a cat. It's not as clean cut as a catbird's cat meow, but it's very cat-like. And they don't start getting here until late September, early October, and then they'll spend the next 6 months or so with us. So it's a winter bird.
Okay. So this is a softer sound than.
Yeah, and I don't do a very good imitation of the catbird meow, but it's very cat-like and. You can maybe go online and search for a vocalization and see if that matches what you hear.
Okay, I'm assuming it's a bird. It may not be even a bird.
Yeah.
Because I haven't seen it.
Right, and the catbird isn't going to show itself all the time. Like I mentioned earlier, they really like the dense shrubs and brush, and they don't like to sit out in the open very much, except when they sing. So he could be skulking in the bushes and hiding and not showing itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
Would the Cornell Ornithology Lab have a sound file of that?
Yeah.
Because they're one of the best in the world.
Yeah, the Cornell Lab is undoubtedly one of the best sites, especially for bird songs. They have the Macaulay Library of Sound. And you can just search Cornell Lab, gray catbird call note, and see if that's it, because you don't want to mix up the song with the call note. We've talked about that in past episodes, how it's very different context of when birds use a song versus a call note. But so the meow of the catbird is a call note.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. You can give us a call right now, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now. And we're going to go next to a question that I have, and that is when photographing birds, I like to go out and try to get pictures. I like to record them as much as possible because I'm recording recording engineer, but I also have friends who like to do that. What is the best way? I mean, would you suggest getting really good zoom, wide angle, deep field lenses? I mean, because you don't want to get up too close to some of these nesting birds, especially in the spring. You're going to disturb right. their nesting patterns.
Our July episode, July of this year, we talked about keeping your distance when you're a bird watcher or a nature photographer. Keeping your distance from birds, especially when they're breeding, we called it fish play. Oh gosh, I don't have it on the top of my head. fish play and boat from 50 yards away, something like that. Anyway, the point is keep your distance. So I would say the answer is to get a really strong lens, but that means shelling out the big bucks.
Right.
So it's not for somebody who's new at this. I would say get started with something reasonable like a 200 or 300 millimeter lens and see if you like it. You know, your pictures aren't going to be full frame, but so what? But the people that are really into it, they're using 500 millimeter lenses, and they cost $5,000 and up. Depending on what you get.
All of that great stuff you see in National Geographic, there's a lot of money went behind
that.
So it's going to be hard to get necessarily that quality, but you can still do relatively good artistic photographs of the natural wildlife with, you know, a regular camera.
Yeah, you can get good stuff with a point and shoot. We have what's called, you have the ability now to use your digital camera or your cell phone with a spotting scope and spend a lot less money on that because everybody's got a cell phone. And then if you can buy a spotting scope, you can connect the two, and it's called digiscoping. And that means putting your camera or your cell phone up to the spotting scope and taking a digital photo through your scope, digiscoping. And I've seen people master that. They've really come up with some good devices that connect the two, a coupler that connects the cell phone to the scope to get away from having that black halo around your image. And I've seen some images that are slam dunk, and that's a fraction of the cost of a camera and setup. But what's interesting about a lot of the nature photographers, and I'm not one of them, so I don't really speak for nature photographers, but I have a bunch of friends that are, and so we're talking about how much money they spend on equipment, but it's also the time. They can get lucky, but a lot of times they have traveled far and stayed in hotels and waited, and so the time and money spent to get that front cover photograph is impressive. And actually, right. I think some of those make the best stories. I've talked to some photographers that they have some amazing stories to tell when they're just sitting there waiting for that photo that they're going to take, or you know, traveling to this area and all of a sudden the weather changes or some other species gets in front of their camera they take pictures of. So I think that's why they do it. You never know what's going to happen. It's totally unpredictable. But I think what always happens is you're going to have a good time.
Right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Casey from Van Zandt County, Texas, you are online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, I have my main question has to do with the Caracara, but I just wanted to point out that we've had a lot of trees die in this area, especially southern red oaks, and with all these big dead trees we've had around here, I thought it would be nice if the pileated woodpecker would move in, and sure enough, I started seeing them last winter, and I've seen them in this area three times.
Cool.
Which, yeah.
That's a great bird.
I'm really shocked at the invasion of Caracaras that has taken place in the last few years around here. And I wonder what effect anybody thinks they might have on the other, you know, raptors that are already around.
Well, you know, not far from you up towards Terrell, in Kaufman County, there have been Caracaras there for decades.
Really?
Yep.
Well, you know, it's funny because we go to Kaufman a lot, and we used to see one around Ola, and we called it the Ola Eagle, and we saw them there originally.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what we had is probably post-oak savannas used to occur in a strip running in that direction from where you are down towards Austin and even farther north of you. And I think that we've really changed the post-oak savanna. You can basically take out the savanna part. We've taken away fire, and it's gotten brushier. But what I'm getting at is that was open grassland with scattered post oaks and other hardwoods, and that was perfect for caracaras. And I think what we have with those Kaufman County birds is what we call a relic or relictual population. I think they hung out there and were sort of self-sustaining, but I think what now you're seeing are birds exploding from the south and meeting back up with their old friends in Kaufman County. But when I was a kid growing up in Dallas, I saw my first caracara in Kaufman County in the 1970s on I-20 driving through there, and I was blown away. So they've been there. That was probably 1977, 76, and I'm sure they were there a long time before that. You could actually
They were like a remnant.
Yeah. So I think if you and I'd have to look at some of our barometers for birds, like the Bird Life of Texas by Harry Church Oberholzer, published in 1974. That account would be good for, I need to reread that. Also, Birds of North Central Texas by Warren Pulich, and that was published in 1988. That would have probably a good account, historical account of caracaras. Yeah. So what I'm getting at is I don't think they're terribly new to your area. I think maybe they're just reclaiming a place where they used to be. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and that's a neat bird. I mean, you see them on the roadsides eating roadkill.
Well, they have a unique profile in flight.
Oh yeah,
Go straight.
And the white patches in the wings make them real unique. They are very different than any other raptor. So it's a cool bird. I like them. And I'm really glad you mentioned the pileated woodpecker, because that's the bird that hooked me as a kid. I noticed birds a lot, but once I saw the pileated and really absorb what they do, I was hooked. And here's Bill's playing the pileated. Let's listen.
I'm sorry, I'm a sound junkie. No. I love the sound of this bird.
Yeah, I do too.
Well, I can tell you, I was thrilled when I saw the first one. I was out jogging one morning.
Uh-huh. That's great. Well, Van.
I'm enjoying your show.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Casey.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We still have time, and lines are open. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I want to go back to the osprey. I noticed where I lived for a while in Florida, and I noticed they love tall light poles as well, because we had them all around the campus, and they are always on the tallest light pole on the field or somewhere nearby, and gave us fits a few years as we were trying to put on a 4th of July celebration on that field, and they kept squawking at us as we were invading their territory.
Uh-huh.
Is this something, I mean, there's nothing up there to protect them other than the height.
The height is the protection. A lot of birds like a commanding view, a commanding perch. They can see. It's kind of like when we built our forts, we like to put them up high where we could see in all directions, danger coming. That's why that osprey was probably perched up there. But it's not only going to perch up high. I've seen them perch on fence posts, which is low, and on the ground. If you go to the coast, you'll see them landed on the beach, and partly because there aren't many tall things there. But there are telephone poles around, but I see them parked on the beach a lot, especially eating on the beach. But they have to worry about other species trying to steal from them, and namely the bald eagle. So the bald eagle is a big threat to stealing the fish prey from the osprey. So they typically want to make sure that they can eat dinner in a relaxed manner, not worry about a pesky bald eagle that's much larger and thus a bigger bully and can steal the fish away easily. And that's one of the reasons that Ben Franklin, one of our country's founding fathers, didn't want the bald eagle to be our national emblem. He lobbied to have the wild turkey. And one of the reasons was he noted, like most people, that the bald eagle does steal from the osprey, and he didn't think that should be our national emblem.
His moral underpinning was no thieves.
That's right.
Well, give us a call at 800-552-8502. You are listening to Bird Calls. And oh, we had Victor from Alexandria online, but I think we lost you, Victor. So give us a call back. Sorry about that, but somehow we dropped your call. And going back to the osprey, they are protected species, are they not?
Yeah, all native species of birds are protected. You don't have to be endangered to be protected. If you have to be native. So there's only a small handful of birds that don't have state and federal protection because they're non-native. Things like the house sparrow, the European starling, the monk parakeet, the Eurasian collared dove, and just a few others. But an osprey is protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. So it's a native and it's protected and it's doing fairly well. So again, you don't have to be, because that's a misconception I hear when I talk to folks, is that they think you have to be rare to be protected, but that's not the case. You have to be native to be protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
So the osprey is not an endangered species necessarily, just a protected. I mean, it's a beautiful species.
Yes.
I think it should be protected as well.
It's not an endangered species, but it still has protection. Yeah.
Well, give us a call at 800-552-8502, and you are listening to Bird Calls. We have Bernard from Lufkin online next. Bernard, what's your question?
Yeah, hi. I have a question about hawks.
Okay.
I moved here from England to Lufkin about 12 years ago, and I've been figuring out most of the birds over the years since then. And I've worked out, like, the red-tailed and red-shouldered hawk, American kestrel, Mississippi kite, and things like that.
Right.
But there seems to be some kind of mid-sized hawks, which are definitely smaller than the red-tailed or red-shouldered, which I can't quite work out. I'm looking in the book and I see things like the Cooper's hawk or sharp-shinned hawk, maybe. But I just want to know which.
Yeah, those
ones are likely to be in East Texas. One of the common ones.
Right. There were three that came to my mind immediately after you listed the ones you've mastered, and you just named two of them: Cooper's and sharp-shinned, and the third one is broad-winged.
Okay.
Those are three species that are. Each one is much smaller than a red-tailed hawk,
right?
And they can be very commonly found in our area. So what's interesting about where you came from, your red-tailed hawk relatives over there were known as buzzards.
Buzzard, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And so, but you come over here, and in Texas and Louisiana, we use, and the rest of the U.S., we use the term buzzard as a slang for vultures, right?
Right?
Yeah, it's very confusing, but
it's a lot easier in England generally or in Britain, because there are rather fewer different species anyway.
That's right, right, that's right.
Coming here.
Yeah.
But is there an easy way or any kind of clues as to how to tell those apart, those three species you mentioned?
Yeah, the broadwing, the date helps a lot. They're not here in the winter months. And they pour through in the migration. You can see them in spring and fall pouring through, coming through the area. A few do stick around and breed here. It's a chunky, stocky, thus Budio. It's in the same genus as red tail and red shoulders, so it's got that chunky, stocky look to it, but it's just a lot smaller chassis. Now, the two others, the Coopers and the Sharpshin, they're both in the same genus, Accipiter, and they're a different chassis. They're long and lean,
right,
with long wings and long, long tail.
Right. Longer tail.
And the wings aren't very long because the short wings are adapted to crash through the forest and the shrubs to get birds moving and get them out. So the Accipiters, the Sharpshin, the Coopers both eat birds, pretty much only birds, and birds that they catch on the wing. And you had Accipiters back home too. That's a genus that you had in England as well. So
I tend to, when I see these, I don't tend to see them for very long. They tend to either be flying along fairly low, or they come up above the tree line, just kind of rise up and then sink back down. So I don't get more than a couple of seconds to see them. It's kind of hard to look for anything identifying.
They don't like to perch out in the open very often. They're not very conspicuous. So you're seeing them perfectly when they're just zooming by. They really like bird feeders that are hopping with songbirds. They really like to camp out near one of those to catch a dove or a cardinal or something else.
Okay. Well, yeah. Between the Coopers and the sharp shin, then, is there any kind of clues as to how you tell them apart?
Yeah, the shape of the tail, if you can get one soaring overhead, the Coopers has more rounded tips to the tail, outer tail, whereas the sharp shin has more of a squared shape to the tail.
Right, okay.
That's really a good feature. Now, the Coopers, if you can see one perch, they have a distinctive dark cap on the top of the head, whereas the sharp shin, it's really dark all the way from bill to the nape.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Oh, well, thanks
great.
Very much.
Thanks, Bernard.
All right. Thank you, Bernard. And unfortunately, we are just about out of time, but we have time to go to Cliff's conservation tip for the month. So what do you have for us this month, Cliff?
Well, the conservation tip ties into our bird of the episode that we profiled, the brown thrasher. And the title of this one is Leaving Brush Piles and Brushy Fence Rows for Birds. So one person's trash might be another bird's sanctuary. What I mean by this is don't throw away, shred, or burn all of your unwanted tree limbs and brush on your property. Instead, consider piling them up in a secluded spot out back. Brush piles, even in urban backyards, can provide great homes and hiding places for birds, as well as providing nest material for birds during the breeding season. The bird we profiled earlier was the brown thrasher. They use brush piles. They also use brushy fence rows, which are fence lines that haven't been mowed or weed-eated, so they provide thick and necessary cover for many birds. Other birds that use brush piles and brushy fence rows in our area include familiar birds like the northern cardinal, Carolina wren, also white-throated sparrows, and eastern towhees. Some lucky few in the Red River listening area might find a Harris's sparrow or a Buick's wren, species found typically more to the west of us. They might find those in their brushy fence row, typically in a more dry upland setting. But for urbanites worried about brush piles being popular homes for rats and mice, those pesky non-native rodents are more likely going to be under your tool shed or in your attic. So keeping brush piles and allowing your fence rows to get brushy means less work for you, the landowner or the homeowner, yet provides good habitat for some of our favorite birds. So do it for the birds.
And plus, a lot of those rodents might just end up being bird food for
That's
some
right.
of those birds as well. So if you've got a good population of good big birds around, they'll take care of that rodent population
right.
real quick. And, well, they're dining luxuriously then. So, Cliff, I want to thank you for joining us once again this month for Bird Calls
right. Thanks,
here
Bill.
From Red River Radio. You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and he is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. He's also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this program. And I especially want to thank Cliff for joining me tonight and giving us his expertise. Bird Calls is made possible by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, plus the 5th Annual Lost Pines Christmas Bird Count Weekend, hosting workshops for birding enthusiasts on Saturday, December 19th at the Hyatt Regency Lost Pines Resort and Spa near Bastrop. Workshops will be taught by experts from the University of Texas at Austin, Texas A&M University, the University of Southern California, and more. The official bird count takes place December 20th, and more information is available at www.visitlostpines.com. The producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford. We had help tonight from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell, and the audio for tonight's program will be posted in a short while on our website at redriverradio.org. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next here on Red River Radio. And then our next Bird Calls will be on Tuesday, January 19th at 6 p.m. And we hope you'll tune in for that.